Hey everyone, this is Lisa Anderson with The Boundless Show. Very happy new year to you all. As we close out the calendar for 2016, we're going to take you down memory lane with a best of show. These are some of our best segments from the year, and you're going to hear clips from them, and hopefully it'll bring back some great memories, or there will be some that you catch that you hadn't heard previously. From our favorite roundtables, we've got a kind of where do we go from here in the wake of the election here in the U.S. Then we have a panel of doctors discussing the realities and treatment of porn addiction. We have a discussion about the long-term effects of your parents' divorce. And then we have my interview with Boundless fans Zach and Sally Crippen, who I am actually taking credit for as a Boundless success story. For our culture roundup, we had some fascinating guests from this past year. First off, economist Joe Price explains the math behind where single women can find single men. Hey, ladies. And then Pastor Rico Tice, with his fabulous English accent, breaks down the art of evangelism in terms that we can actually understand. For the new year, Kathy Lipp gets us on the road to living a clutter-free life. And down-to-earth Pastor John Weiss helps us figure out how to be Jesus wherever we are. Finally, for our inboxes, we've included some of our favorite experts and questions: how to deal with negative emotions with psychiatrist Carl Benzio, whether or not to tell on a married man who's posing as a single person online, answered by yours truly. And finally, Joshua Rogers advises a young man on how to let a girl down easy. Enjoy, and here we go. All right, well, here we are for our roundtable. And many of you know, if you've basically been alive, that here in the U.S., we had a historic election earlier this week. And basically, a lot of decisions made at the national and even local and state levels, of course. And so I had to assemble some people here to kind of break it down with me. I have Brother Andrew.
Hello.
Andrew Hess is here. Love it when he can come be part of the show, and he's going to be our resident millennial today, even though he's an old soul. We're letting him in just based on actual statistics. So, Andrew, welcome. I've got Pastor Mark Bates here from Village 7 Presbyterian Church in Colorado Springs. Woo-woo.
Hello. Hey. Good to be here.
Great to have him. So he's going to basically have to just pray us on out here. And then for expertise on what actually went down and how we move forward and what this means, the implications for evangelicals and for the country, Carrie Earle, who's our Vice President of Public Policy here at Focus on the Family. Carrie, welcome.
Hi, Lisa.
Oh, great to have you all. This is a great, this is going to be a great amount or a number of perspectives weighing in here. So the first thing I want to ask is, you know, going to be honest, some of us had election parties to watch the returns because we wanted an excuse to eat snacks. And so, but it was interesting heading into the election. What would you say? I just want to kick it off broadly. What were things that you were hearing, especially in the last few weeks, the last month? How did you in particular pray? What were your kind of feelings about this? You know, and just knowing that there were many people on different sides of issues, candidates, including Christians, including evangelicals. And so what would you say your thoughts and feelings were heading into the election earlier this week?
Well, Lisa, I'll start out. I mean, I've watched politics for about 30 years now, and this was one of the most divisive election years that we've seen. And every time people go, I'm tired of the ads, I'm tired of the fighting, but this one really blew the out of the water. So I know for us here at Focus on the Family, we were praying for there to be healing in relationships because there was so much divisiveness, social media, regular media, kind of Christians against Christians, and we got to come out of this with clean hearts and hands and intact relationships. So we were praying for that. I know we were also praying just for God's justice, for fair and accurate elections. I mean, what an amazing thing, guys, that we can do a transition of government without blood or bullets. that's amazing to be able to do that. So to have God's justice, to have an outcome that people could come together. And so we'll see how that goes, but it's going to take all of us to cooperate with that. If it had gone the other direction, you would have had also people disappointed. But I think as believers, it is important for us to respect our brothers and sisters, be tender with them, continue to move forward in love, because the world's watching how we respond to this.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is the most divided I've ever seen the evangelical community. And particularly, it seems even generationally, there's been a pretty sharp divide between those over 50 who are evangelicals and those who are under 50. And even people holding the exact same values, if you ask them their position on any number of issues, they held the same position, but they supported different candidates. And it has been very intense. And so certainly healing and restoration is certainly one of the things we're praying for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the thing that struck me was that there, you know, I kind of expected as we went into this that there was going to be a lot of people that had really strong opinions. But when you look at comments, social media engagement, ways people are engaging, there just seemed like there wasn't any peace about it at all. And so I kind of, that was my prayer. And it kind of, as I've been talking to people, was encouraging them, like, as Christians, we should have kind of this baseline level of peace. And that no matter what happens, like, God is in control and things are going to be okay. And I think that there was a lot of people that got swept up into it and became Chicken Little a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like if this result happens, whatever that was, like, it's going to be over. And we use language where it's just like, I don't know how we would move forward. Like, yeah. How are we going to survive?
And what, I mean, we just have a couple minutes left here. So I would like to also address, because, you know, we're talking to a largely millennial audience, and I love, I talked a couple years ago about when Craig Groeschel spoke at Catalyst and basically gave a super awesome message, y'all need to look it up, on millennials needing to respect those who have gone before them. And this smug idea that, well, I'm 22 and I know what's what and I need to just tell everyone what's what and I'm going to go stand on the stage at Catalyst and Passion and just be awesome. And I'm like, you know, and Craig said this too, no, you need to sit down and just be quiet because I was that at 22 and I was super dumb. So what does it look like now moving ahead to respect the authority over us, to, you know, again, to say what we want to say, what we're allowed to say with our religious freedom, but also to act and to speak in a manner of respect, in biblically speaking, for those who are in authority over us at any level where we are?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really what it comes down to. And again, you think back to when the scriptures were written, about all authority being established by God, that we are to pray for those in authority, be at peace with those even that we disagree with. That was at a time the church was in first and second centuries. I mean, it was almost illegal to be a Christian. You could be burned in Nero's garden for professing faith. So those scriptures come to us at a time when the church had no voice, had no standing, had nothing that we have in the culture today. Mm-hmm. How much more God will look to us and say, look what I've given you, church in the United States of America. I expect that God would hold us to even a higher standard of accountability, of behavior, of seeking him. And after every election, people's hearts may be open in a way that they weren't before. So we need to take that opportunity.
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, every day of Christ's life, there was corruption in the government. There was immorality happening. I mean, if you dive into what happened in Rome, Tiberius Caesar, Herod, like, there was gross stuff happening. And at the end of his life, Christ said, I fulfilled my mission. I accomplished everything that God had given me to do. And that's what God calls us to do. Like, whatever is happening in the global scene, God has a purpose for us, a mission for us, and says, focus on that. Focus on that. Don't get so sidetracked with all the things going on in the world. And should we care about that? Should we pray about that? Absolutely. We should pray for Trump every day. We should pray for him and pray that God would, because if we don't believe that God could change his heart in the way he changed our hearts and make him one of the godliest presidents ever, then we don't believe the gospel. Mm-hmm. The gospel says God could get a hold of his life in a way where he would be the most godly president ever. Mm-hmm. And he can do that change. And so why not ask God to do that?
Yeah.
And even if he's not godly, if he doesn't get converted, you have Daniel working you know, among the most evil emperors in history. I mean, we're talking about brutal, evil people. Esther, her husband was one of the most, despite the movie, was a terrible, terrible man. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Paul writing about respecting the emperor, which again, at that time was probably Nero. And so we have to be able to work within those structures, holding our convictions, doing it in love, doing it gracefully. And I think it can be an exciting time for the church.
Well, now for our roundtable, we're actually going to be talking about pornography, which is not super exciting, but necessary. And fortunately, we have a great group of guys here to talk about it. They are experts, and they are in ministry on this front. And so it is, again, a group of docs from our Physicians Resource Council here at Focus on the Family. We have doctors... I like saying that, doctors. It saves me some time. We have doctors Hager, White, and Benzio here. Hey, guys.
Hey, great to be with you.
So the term pornography addiction, I think a lot of when I talk in friend groups about this, it's especially the women that literally just don't understand this. Can someone break down, like, biologically speaking, what is going on? I think women are just like, this is a sin problem and guys just need to stop it. And what, not understanding, I mean, that there are chemical things going on in the brain. Can someone, like, break that down for us so we understand what an addiction to pornography is?
At the core of addiction are two key principles. The first is compulsion. Mm-hmm. So you're doing it whether you want to or not. But then the second component is despite negative consequences. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we could talk about, you know, withdrawals, dependence, tolerance, and all those other things. But at the core, it's important to understand that there's a compulsive component as well as despite negative consequences. Mm-hmm. The other key thing is the focus on self, the focus on self. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, with addictions, you're focusing on self to the point where you're disregarding other very important issues. Mm-hmm. As we talk about this issue about sex, really, ideal sex is where one member in the partnership is actually, we're going to talk about marital partnership here, mm-hmm. is focused on the needs of that marriage partner, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And things break down very quickly when a person is just focusing on their needs. Mm-hmm. So sexual deviance has become so rampant in the culture that there are so many things propping up. But ultimately, what you're seeing is I'm focusing on what I need, you know, to the exclusion and disregard of what my partner needs. Hmm. And that really is what moves us towards addressing it. Ultimately, that woman's real issue is you're not prioritizing what I need, mm-hmm. ultimately.
Okay.
And your needs involve temporary satisfaction rather than focusing on the permanent satisfaction of a relationship, the permanent satisfaction of being free from this.
Okay.
And we have this biochemical process in our brain that's, mm-hmm. even though it's not a chemical that a person's taking in, like an alcohol or a drug, it does affect our circuitry in our brain. And the spiritual and psychological aspects can disrupt that chemistry. So to me, the opposite of addiction is belonging. Mm-hmm. And we were designed to belong to God. Mm. And He made us to worship. And pornography is the one addiction where it's impossible to do by yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's interacting with images of other people or actually interacting with other people in a sex addiction. So pornography sort of allows that connection without really having connection.
Okay.
And especially for males, there's so much relational wounding that they have and insecurity and impotence that they feel about themselves that they need to connect with somebody, but they're afraid to actually connect with somebody and be vulnerable. So pornography provides that sort of outer coping mechanism that allows us a sense of belonging, but, mm-hmm. you know, in a very superficial kind of way, but it gratifies that, and they end up sort of belonging to the pornography as opposed to a healthy relationship with God, themselves, or others.
So knowing what y'all do of having now talked to people who, like we said at the front end of the segment, you know, reached a point of desperation or trying to get help, for that person that's listening right now, whether male or female, and they're like, okay, yeah, I don't know. I don't even know who to talk to. I don't know next steps. I don't know whatever. What do they need to know, and what is the next most effective step for them to take?
I would say being able to be honest, first of all, mm-hmm. and say, hey, look, I have a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, this is inappropriate. It's not helping me. And there's hope, and transformation is definitely possible. Mm-hmm. I think the other big lie that was in my life and in many people that struggle with addiction's life is that the addiction way is the easier way. Mm. Satan makes us think that doing it the right way is a lot harder mm. and a lot more sacrifice and a lot more cost. Well, when I was struggling in my addiction, it cost me a whole lot more than doing things the right way. Mm-hmm. And so just realize, whether it's the fruit of the flesh that you reap or financial or legal or relational problems, whether it's your brain chemistry being impacted, there's a lot of cost to continuing in your addiction. It doesn't have to be that way. Mm-hmm. So be open with somebody, a trusted person, whether in your family or your church. Talk to somebody about it, and they'll mm-hmm. help you find the help that you can get.
Okay. In my own life, it was coming to the point of realization of what my root issues were. Mm-hmm. Rejection, abandonment, abuse hmm. that caused me to want to act out to correct that in my life. And rather than choosing a healthy way to do that, I chose a dysfunctional way to do that. Hmm. And so I encourage all the people that I talk to, look back and find out what is it that motivated you, caused you to go in this direction. Stop focusing so much on the pornography, on the alcoholism, whatever it is, and focus on what drove you to this point.
So the advice would range. I mean, you're talking about some people who need professional help, mm-hmm. and, you know, that's where it may start with your family medicine doctor, you know, mm-hmm. saying, hey, I need some help. I need mm-hmm. a referral to someone that can help me with these issues, mm-hmm. okay? But where if a person just has, you know, questions and they recognize the challenges, I would say there's a powerful role for mentorship. Mm-hmm. I think it's a matter of looking at people, whether in your community or outside of your community, and saying, okay, well, that's what I want. Mm-hmm. And having a conversation, pulling that person aside. Hey, man, can I just ask you some questions? Mm-hmm. You know, I admire what you're about, and I'd just like to talk to you, mm-hmm. you know, and find out how you got there.
We are going to talk about divorce and its effect on families, specifically on the adult children of divorce. Let's go ahead and just let's open it up and just say, I mean, how your memories of divorce affecting yourself. I mean, some of you, were you pretty young when your parents got divorced? I know you were, Eric. Yes. You were small.
Yeah, I was about 1 year old. Okay. So
I don't
never
even know, remember your parents.
No,
together.
I see them together now at different functions, and I'm like, whoa, that's weird. I can never picture you two together.
Okay, so that's weird. How about you, Kat?
I was about 8 or 9 when that happened.
Okay. And you've actually walked through divorce several times.
Well, one divorce and 2 deaths.
Okay. Wow.
So mom was on her third, and she just lost her third husband.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Okay. So that's a lot of marriage and remarriage. Yeah. Okay.
And I was 15.
Okay.
So I was...
the teenage years.
Yeah, the teenage years. Mm-hmm. That definitely messed me up. Okay. Thanks, mom and dad.
Okay. Wow. You know, it's interesting because one thing that made us think to discuss this topic was there was a New York Times article, Never Too Old to Hurt from Your Parents' Divorce. And we often, when we talk about it, whether it's the news or culturally or sociologists, it's always the effect on small children. And What does this mean? You know, tearing the home apart and kids being latchkey kids or, you know, with mom 1 week, dad this week, mom weekend, you know, mom during the week, dad on weekends and all that transfer. But I think a lot of people forget that as you grow into adulthood, the effects still remain or they even change. Mm-hmm. And so what did it look like for identity with you and where were kind of key benchmark life points as far as that played out?
With me, I was considered like my dad's favorite. Mm. And so with my dad out of the picture, I was in the minority. And so I felt like, and I don't know, even at that young age, if I really understood it until later when I'm doing a lot of processing, but that I tried to perform better and to be accepted by my mom. So I think I worked harder to be accepted by her, and then that was the reason I wasn't attracted to doing a lot of mischief outside of the home, because I wanted to be like her. And
Do you think she set that expectation, or that was just you putting, okay.
Yeah. So I think there was a little bit there.
Okay. Okay.
And I also, I think it also impacted the trajectory of my life, in that my dad didn't keep in touch with me. I would reach out to him, but there was, he was going through his own crisis. So, but I felt like, okay, I've been not accepted by him. And then my stepfather, who I considered also a father for 20 years until he passed away, was not a strong father figure. And so there's been a repeated theme in my life where men have just not been strong enough. Mm. But yet I am, you know, trying to not be too strong, but I was forced mm-hmm. to be strong.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Good. Good points.
Well, and for me, it was, there was always this tension, because within a few months of my parents' divorce, I got my driver's license. Mm-hmm. And so the understanding, or, you know, it was never said, but I would have to make sure that I went down to see my dad, and he lived 2 hours away. Mm. So, you know, picture a 16-year-old. I can't even imagine that now with my own kids, but a 16-year-old driving down the highway going to my dad's. And if I didn't do a certain amount of things, if I didn't call him, you know, enough, or there's always that guilt of, oh my goodness, I didn't call him, and so now that I call him, he's going to give me all these guilt trips, and you know, and being a 16-year-old, and, you know, being doing 16-year-old things, football games and fun stuff like that, you've got that adult responsibility of mm-hmm. maintaining a communication channel, which, you know, looking back, I'm like, what were my parents thinking? You know, but they did the best they could, and my mom was always supportive. Neither one of them, for their part, neither one of them tore the other one down. Mm. So I really, really appreciated that. Mm-hmm. And especially looking back, I appreciate that so much.
Yeah. What would be your advice to those in our audience who are living out, you know, they're young adults, living out relationships with their parents? What would be your recommendation to them to relate to their parents, love their parents well, when maybe trust has been broken, when maybe they feel like they didn't have great examples, or they're being forced to because of just dysfunction and whatever, you know, parents are trying to drive a wedge between them and the other parent or what, you know, I mean, how did you guys negotiate mm-hmm. that space of just walking it out and living out of your faith in light of that, especially after, you know, coming to Christ and knowing that that was, you know, the thing you needed to do?
I think for me, I'd say three things. One, practically with your parents, make sure that there's good boundaries as far as them not speaking negatively about one another. Mm-hmm. Two, say, get some help, talk with someone, mm-hmm. go to counseling. Mm-hmm. I was privileged to be mentored by a professor of family therapy for 15 years. So mm-hmm. I got free therapy, I think, for 15 years.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was great. And then three, to let God define you, to really let him do that heart work, mm-hmm. just telling you who you are. And I think this is an area where the enemy likes to come in and say, well, you'll never get married, or you'll always have marital problems, or whatever it is, and to really let God replace those lies with his truth.
Mm-hmm. Good idea.
The number one would be forgiveness. Mm-hmm. My heart breaks for those that don't have a relationship. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't keep a relationship with your divorced parents, and then if they have remarriage, the forgiveness aspect is so, so huge, because most of the time the kids don't get a say in who the parents marry. Mm-hmm. 100% of the time, I would say, but I don't know. I'm sure there are other statistics. Yeah. But, you know, it's just that you didn't get to choose their partner, mm-hmm. and they are not blood to you. They are not, mm-hmm. you're not from them, I guess. And so there's all these different intentions and just people being different mm-hmm. than I, when Brian and I first got married, I'm like, your parents have their crazy mm-hmm. and my parents have my crazy, mm-hmm. are crazy mm-hmm. and neither one of them makes sense mm-hmm. to the other person. Mm-hmm. And that's how it is with step families too, is right. you just don't get it. But the forgiveness aspect is just huge because you're going to get your toes stepped on and yeah. man, pain's going to happen. So.
Yeah. Can I just want to add my bit. Yeah. Definitely the forgiveness part. Once I think a big part for me for moving forward was not judging my parents anymore and really seeing them in myself, and that part of them is in me. And then the temptation is to judge your parents. But that point where mm-hmm. I really started to forgive them, because I really believe that unless you forgive your parents, that you are bound to repeat it.
Yeah. So we have the opportunity to chat today with Zach and Sally Crippen. Hey, guys.
Hey, hi. Thanks so much for having us.
Well, very good to have you. I have to give a special shout out to Sally because she has listened to every Boundless episode that there has been, and we're into the 400s at this point. So that is super cool. And she's just bringing Zach along with her for whatever reason. Yes. Do you ever listen to the Boundless show, or are you just a tag along here?
Definitely a tag along. Okay, for sure.
So maybe I made you listen to an episode one time.
That's possible.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wouldn't doubt.
But yeah, I think I've been listening for 10 years.
That is so cool. Okay. Well, this is kind of fun because I told you guys that I want to talk about two things. One is the story of how you guys met and married, because there was a little bit of you kind of have the story, and Sally, you'll know this because I'm sure you know Suzanne Hadley-Goslin, who mm-hmm. writes for us, who told her own story about meeting her husband.
So that's
8
the story.
Years. Oh.
Yeah.
Well, aren't we jumping ahead? Okay. I was telling this. Okay. So crazy stuff, and you find yourself kind of in a similar situation. But let's go ahead and start talking about that, because you were kind of, you know, going through college. You had finished college and were figuring out what you were going to do next. And right. then tell us how you came about meeting Zach in the process.
Yeah, so I came to Colorado Springs the fall after I graduated from college, which was in 2009. And I went to the John Jay Institute, which mm-hmm. is now in Philadelphia. But I met Zach, and he was then a sophomore,
yeah.
at the Air Force Academy.
Okay.
And so I knew that he was probably about 19 and I was 21.
Okay.
But the first time we met, there was chemistry.
Definitely chemistry, and, yeah. I saw her across the room and thought, wow, she's really
okay.
pretty.
But okay. I don't think we really took it seriously.
No, I think I sent her a few Facebook messages afterward to try mm-hmm. to connect and see if we had any shared interests.
We didn't see each other very much during the semester that I was in Colorado Springs.
Right.
There are a few times that we saw each other, and one of those times was at an Air Force football game. And one of my friends was trying to figure out how old Zach actually was.
Okay.
Because we thought maybe, I mean, best case scenario, he's 20. Mm-hmm. And so we find, we're talking case. About this. And because I was very concerned about it at the time. I had in my head, my mom had always told me that I would marry someone who was older and more mature. Uh-huh. And that's what I had in my head. And so my friend mentions the 1/2 + 7 rule.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, well, Sally, you could marry someone who was 18 or older. And okay. I said, 18? I could never marry someone who was 18. And little did I know that Zach was 18 because he started college a year early. And that pretty much derailed all of
right, because I was sitting right in front of Sally at the game.
Okay. Were you also having these similar like age thoughts, or was this just Sally obsessing about the age?
No, I was
being too old.
Yeah, I was totally on board with it.
Okay.
The age was
not fazed by it at all.
Yeah, not at all.
He was okay. very confident 18-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Okay.
Or foolish. I don't know.
Now, was there any? Because we should mention too, when we were talking about this before we started taping, that Zach's dad actually worked for Focus on the Family for a while, and then also now is in charge of the John Jay
That's
Institute,
right, yeah.
which you were at. So was it kind of like, oh my goodness, not only is this guy 18 and at the Air Force Academy, but he's actually the son of like the founder
yeah,
of this.
Yeah, and slash my and, professor.
Right.
Yeah.
So now you're going to be like all spiritually interrogated
right.
and all make sure that you're, you know everything about the founding fathers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
it definitely
a lot
felt,
on the table
yeah,
there.
It definitely felt like a lot of pressure. And I mean, as soon as I found out, after that football game, the reason why he stopped talking to me was that he was 18 and I had offended him. I just figured I had missed, I just dodged a bullet.
Yeah.
So I was just like, well, that would have been a failed relationship. So
yeah.
Yeah. So I left Colorado Springs, went on to DC, eventually went on to law school. And it wasn't until another 2 years that we actually got back in touch.
And that was through, Zach, your well-planned out reconnaissance about like law programs or something that you were going to try to ask her her opinion on these. So tell a little bit about how you kind of re-entered her world.
Yeah, so first of all, Sally and I remained friends on Facebook.
Okay.
And so...
Well, don't we all?
But we were just connected. Yeah, so we never communicated.
So the ubiquity of Facebook makes it really easy for you to, you know, check up on anybody's profile and just see what they're up to. So this was my senior year by this point. And I was initially, early in my first semester, I was interested in going to law school. And so I started looking at some law schools and then thinking about contacting some friends who were at law school. And Sally, I wouldn't really describe as a friend at that point because we really had, I think we exchanged one email since we had met. But she looked really pretty on Facebook. And she was at University of Virginia Law School, which is a top 10 school and really good and one that I was definitely interested in. So I shot her a Facebook message and said, hey, let's chat sometime.
But that was in October, and we couldn't talk until the end of November.
Right.
And by that point, Zach had won a Rhodes Scholarship. Hmm. So law school was out the window. He was going to England. So I figured, we're not going to talk because he's going to England. He's not going to law school, clearly.
Yeah. But I had other plans. So Sally was initially willing to talk to me about law school. And even though I was no longer able to go to law school at that point, I still reached out and said, hey, we should still just catch up and kind of see what's going on. So we did. And we had a conversation at the end of November that was supposed to be kind of a 20 to 30 minute catch up. And I think it ended up being like 2 hours.
I want to say an hour.
Okay, maybe the second one was longer. Okay, I'm exaggerating. But it was a long time. It was longer than I thought it would be.
Yeah, definitely.
And then we ended up talking again, I think 2 weeks after that. And then a week after that, and then a few days after that. And so every conversation got longer, it seemed, and more intense and in-depth and enjoyable. Okay. So I think it was right around Christmas time we started realizing that this could be something. Mm-hmm. And it was in February that I was able to fly out to Charlottesville, Virginia, and ask Sally if she officially wanted to date me. Mm-hmm. And then we started dating.
And then you got a link to 25 Boundless articles to vet you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this is what
I've heard that before. Yeah, exactly.
So then we started dating in February, and it was all long distance because Sally was still in law school and I was still at the academy. So basically, every time we had, you know, an extended weekend or something, we would try to make it happen. So I flew out to Charlottesville for my spring break as well.
Then I flew out to Colorado Springs for his graduation in May.
And the whole like week prior to graduation and everything. So we tried to pack in as much time together as we possibly could. And in May, we decided that basically this was worth pursuing. We had a really serious conversation where it was kind of interesting, actually. We almost broke up, but we ended up deciding that this was actually really worth it. And so it was a really good opportunity for us to kind of redefine what we were doing and have a really honest conversation with each other about where we were going.
And what would it would require
what it would look
to
like,
have a long to get married eventually, whenever that would be.
Okay, so Sally, what were you thinking at this point? Because you're clearly like in law school, you kind of have your ducks in a row as far as what you think you're going to do.
Right.
I mean, and so how, I mean, this is throwing a wrench in the plan. Were you trying to make everything work or were you having the conversation with yourself of just like, something is going to have to go if I'm going to hitch my wagon to this guy and I have some decisions to make.
Right.
Yeah, and I just want to jump in here real quick and brag on Sally a little bit because Sally was at a top 10 law school. Which they're hard to get into and she was doing well there. Before that, she was a staffer on Capitol Hill for a U.S. congressman. Before that, she was at a think tank in D.C. So Sally had a really good resume and had really good opportunities in front of her if she were to stay on the JD track and finish that out. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, made the decision a little more difficult.
Yeah, but I think by that point, the end of my first year of law school, I had just come to this realization that the most important thing to me that I wanted to have done by the end of my life was to have a family. And even if that meant not pursuing all of my gifts and talents that God had given me, and I think I'd come to the realization that the idea of balancing marriage and family with a career is really a misnomer, and that you something has to give, something has to be shortchanged. And I was really compelled by Zach, and I was really compelled by our relationship and where it could go. And thanks to some conversations with some mentors, we realized that a long distance marriage or a long term engagement was not going to be what God had in mind for us. And
neither of those is what God planned for marriage.
Yeah, that wasn't going to contribute to flourishing lives, right. let alone a flourishing marriage. Right. And I knew that I wasn't going to be the one responsible for our livelihood. It was going to be Zach. Hmm. So if anyone was going to give up their career, it was going to be me. Plus, he was in the Air Force, so mm-hmm. he couldn't get out of that. And so then we got engaged in August, and we got married in December. Hmm. He went to England in September, came back for our wedding in December. We moved to England together in January.
Wow.
And I wasn't disappointed. I mean, I would have loved to be a pro-life lawyer, which was my goal, mm-hmm. but I was thrilled to have this opportunity to build a life with him, with Zach, and I just realized that the goals, what's required to have a flourishing career that is God-honoring as a woman, what's required for that is really fundamentally incompatible with what's required to have a flourishing marriage and family.
To move, if you're ready or not, give it all that you've got, turn it up now, you got to move, it's your chance to fly, with your head held high, right about now, you got to move, don't let this moment pass you by, this is your time, you got to move, if you're ready or not, give it all that you've got, turn it up now, you got to.
Well, folks, for our culture segment, we have the privilege of a conversation with Joe Price. He's an economist from Brigham Young University. And I will say on the front end of this segment that even though he's from BYU and is a Mormon by faith, he is also a researcher, a sociologist, an economist who has done a lot in the realm of male-female relationships, marriage, and just statistically speaking, where men and women are in our culture today. And so he just gave a talk to our staff here at Focus on the Family titled, Where Are All the Good Marriageable Men? And you know that I have asked this question. And so I appreciate the insight he has on this front. And can you just give us a little info, Joe, to kind of set the stage for why this question even needs to be asked and why you, a dude who has been married since early college and now has 7 kids, why do you even care about this? What impact does it have on you personally? Well, other than you need to get those kids married at some point.
I mean, so personally, I in grad school, I had people ask me all the time, that's crazy that you're married. Isn't it going to slow you down? Hmm. It's going to make it harder to graduate. And my experience was just the opposite.
Yeah.
And so it made me wonder if that's true in other settings where we're discouraging marriage and places where it actually could bring a lot of benefit into people's lives.
So what would you say, you know, what is the research overall? What has it been bearing out as you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, so we've seen a large decline in marriage and we've mm-hmm. seen a large delay in marriage. And one of the explanations is that there's a shortage of marriageable men. Mm-hmm. And I thought there could be two things that could be happening. One is there's men out there, we're just not finding them. Mm-hmm. So it's the matching process that's failing.
Yeah.
Or the other thing is that even if I had a perfect social planner that could just match everyone up, mm-hmm. the question is, would everyone have a match?
Yeah.
So it looks like people match on age, education, income. They probably match on attractiveness and religious preferences, though I don't get to see that in the data. Mm-hmm. And the real problem is we have this thing called hypergamy. Mm-hmm. So men tend to marry women that are younger, less educated, and lower income. Hmm. But coupled with that is we now live in a world where women are doing really well educationally. Mm-hmm. So on most college campuses, there's about 50% more women than men. And so this combination of men wanting to marry women with less education, but then having less education themselves, it's just setting us up for a mismatch in the market.
Yeah, that's true. So any, you know, I know you kind of put 3 possible solutions yeah. forward, one which was frightening, and a couple others that, you know, certainly had their various aspects of potential. Could you just talk through those briefly and then talk about the implications for the church as a result?
Okay, sure. I'm going to skip the first one. It's a Babylonian solution that it would be impossible to implement today.
Yeah.
But the second is actually affirmative action for men in colleges. Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting case where
when colleges become too female, they actually become less attractive both to female students and male students. So this is a case where as if I'm a high school girl, I might actually be excited for affirmative action for men, because that would give me the chance to go to a college where the sex ratio is a little closer. And this, the sex ratio has a huge effect on the hookup culture, dating with a purpose, marriage rates. And so this is a case where actually the group that's affected by affirmative action might actually advocate affirmative action for the other group because of this matching market. So that's
which is crazy, because it seems so unfair. Like, women like, that is not fair. We should have equal access to getting into these schools. But you're saying that ultimately it could work in their favor.
Yeah, and you're seeing this happen already. So it, there's some, if you see a college where there's a pretty equally balanced sex ratio, it's either because that school is dominated by STEM fields or it's because they're already doing affirmative action to try to keep the match equal. And then the other, I think, bigger issue, which is more a narrative script as a community, is to not discourage early marriage. So when your daughter who's 20 says, "Oh, I just got engaged," like, like, actually that should be a moment of celebration, and not something to say, "Oh, you should wait till you're 30." Because actually, if she found the right guy, getting married at 20 is going to allow her to grow and develop as an individual and as a couple over the entire. And the other neat thing about this is she will get married at a point in her life where a lot of the joint decisions haven't been made yet, and they can actually work those out together. And it's also a point in their life where they're really poor, which you think of as a bad time to get married, but it actually creates a reference point for the rest of your life that you will look back on those poor years as, like, I don't know, like, really special time in your life. But also it makes you appreciate everything that you get. So you're like, okay, you know, our house isn't great right now, but it's way better than that dumpy apartment we had in college.
Yeah. Well, hey, everyone. Here we are for our culture segment today on The Boundless Show. And I'm very privileged to introduce you to a friend from across the pond. And he's across the pond if you're in the U.S., but if you're across the pond, then he's just there in your country. And quite frankly, if you're somewhere else in the world, you have to figure out where he's from in relation to you. But Rico Tice is here from England. Welcome, Rico.
It's lovely to be here, Lisa.
You have written a book called Honest Evangelism, How to Talk About Jesus Even When It's Tough. And I think it's weird for me to say, but I'll just say it, that you're kind of like an expert in evangelism. I mean, you know.
Yes.
Not,
I mean, I
come not like Jesus was an expert in evangelism. But
look, I come from a non-Christian family. The people I love most often have died without hope in Christ. And so I think that just gives an urgency to the things. And I wrote the book Honest Evangelism. There were two uses of the word honest. One, let's be honest with non-Christians, unbelievers, about what the heart of the gospel is. And, you know, there is a judgment to come and Jesus died to save us from that. But secondly, let's be honest with Christians that actually, as we speak to people about Jesus, we can get rejected. That is part of what we should expect. And if we're not expecting that, when we do cross the pain line and get hit, we can often then say, well, I'm not doing that again. And so it's trying to say to people, let's keep talking and let's trust God to be sovereign. And let's expect the fact there's going to be rejection and find our identity in Christ.
Yeah. So here's one of the challenges that I see here in the U.S., especially in the church, is, and that is not even engaging our enemies. So Rico, we are, you know, why groups of my friends, we are moving from our jobs to our Christian friends, to our Christian Bible studies, to church, to ministering in the church, to doing, and then we sit down and try to tally up who we even come into contact with throughout a given week in a meaningful way that doesn't even know Jesus, and we're finding ourselves hard pressed. How can we, one, introduce ourselves? I mean, for those who work, you know, workplaces are a great place and stuff, but what does it look like for us to more intentionally engage with the world? And then how can we take a little bit of this fear out of the fear of the need to separate our faith from, okay, then here's the rest of the way I live my life? How can we integrate?
Well, great questions. What we're saying in London is, and again, I can't speak here, but we're saying, number one, celebrate the people on your street, the people you work with. God has sovereignly, Acts 17, 24 to 28, put you there. He's decided their times and places and yours so that you can reach out and they can meet Jesus. So that's what's really going on in the history of the world. It's about people coming to know Jesus. God, who's made the world, has decided he wants us to know his son. So when you meet people, God has decided that you meet the person in the lift, you live next door to them, whatever. Celebrate them, create the relationship. We're often so bad at that. So find out about them. Key to that, ask questions. Just on the street, when you do meet them, stop. So, you know, I make a point of, you know, maybe being a bit late for a meeting because I'm just wanting to stop and engage. Secondly, serve. So you know, live such good lives that though they speak against you, 1 Peter 2:11-12, they see your good works and give praise to your Father in heaven. There's a tension there, but you know, we try and involve on my street, I'm trying to involve the non-Christians on the street in the social action we do. Say, come and help us make food on a Friday night, sandwiches for the homeless. Come and help us in the day shelter on a Saturday. Come out at 3 a.m. with the tea run that we do. So I get them to be involved. Mm-hmm. But then thirdly, there is a telling thing, which is, as you get to know them, work out what the right question for them is, which does cross the pain line. I talk about in the book, the pain line. So, you know, it might be there's a guy at the end of the street who's is a gay couple. My son loves to help him water his plants. But actually for me to say one day, look, I know you love the gardening, but, you know, where does it all come from? Mm-hmm. Now, that's just a question. Now, it may be that I then hit hunger or I hit hostility. I've got to risk that. Mm-hmm. My identity's got to be in Christ. If I hit hostility, Matthew 10, wipe the dust off your feet. Just exit. You know, go on talking about the plants. Mm-hmm. But it may well be you hit hunger. But I'm often saying to people those four steps. I'm saying being, celebrate people, serving them, secondly. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, telling. And fourthly, exiting if it's not working. But I think once people have got that in their minds, that's been a real help in terms of just with the relationships that are there or the people that are around them, just looking to be intentional.
Hmm. All right. Well, I said that I was going to ask you about getting married at 42. Yeah. So I am, because we talk a lot here about dating and relationships at the Boundless Show. Did you feel called to singleness in early adulthood? How did this come about? Did you just meet your wife and you were like, okay, I need to not go the John Stott route? What's going
No, look, I was absolutely mentored by John Stott in terms of his example. Mm-hmm. So for me, 1 Corinthians 7, which was, you know, if you can stay single, you're more free to do the work of the Lord. And I saw that in John's life. And then Christianity Explored came along. So I basically, by 28, 27, had four jobs. I was working as a curator at All Souls. I was doing the missions around the place and helping with evangelism nationally in England. I was trying to raise money for Christianity Explored, and that meant lots of donor relationships. Mm. And then I was trying to create the material and push it out. So those four different things, well, it was just consuming. And so basically my 20s and 30s were, I mean, I just knew there wasn't the opportunity to marry. But then I came to the point where just for me personally, I just thought, I'm not coping well single. I don't seem to naturally have the gift of singleness. So I saw in John Stott a contentment with being single. And with me, I didn't sense that. I was always battling with it. There was always a loneliness.
Hmm. Yeah. So what would be your encouragement to single adults, maybe who are now in their 30s and wondering, like, I want to get married. I don't feel I have the gift of singleness, but it's just not happening. How do you encourage them to be proactive, but also trust God with their story?
Well, I think, first of all, it is amazing being single because of the opportunity. Mm-hmm. So I look back, I'm so glad I spent my 20s and 30s just absolutely full on serving Christ. The opportunity was amazing. But what I found is every 3 weeks there'd be a black night of loneliness when I really felt lonely, and it will pass. Mm-hmm. You know, I just had to hold the line, not do anything stupid like go and look at pornography, and, you know, have good accountability on that. Mm-hmm. Particularly when I went on holiday, actually. I found I'd go on holiday and the first couple of days I'd feel searingly lonely, and then it would be okay. So I think it's seeing opportunity and loneliness, those two things. I think, you know, that was really good. But also in terms of looking for someone to marry and how do we cope with that? Primarily, I think we've got to be walking with Jesus, because it may, I mean, I'm married to Lucy, it's wonderful, but Lucy might die this week, and I've buried spouses of people. So the final place of my emotional well-being has got to be my walk with the Lord Jesus.
I have Kathy Lipp here. Hey, Kathy. Welcome back to Colorado.
Glad to be with you.
You come here a lot, though, because you're always on our daily broadcast.
I am. I can't get enough of them. What can I say?
You are just a fan favorite. So I hear, anyway. And now you will be on Boundless.
I'm very excited to be on Boundless. I really am.
You have a definition for clutter. What would you say clutter actually is?
I believe that clutter is indecision.
Okay.
And so we don't know what to do with it. We don't know the right person to give it to. Mm-hmm. We don't know whether we're going to use it again. Mm-hmm. So it's an indecision that is just sitting there. And if you look at most of our kitchen counters. And by the way, I know you hate clutter.
I do.
I will say this. This is not a, hey, I've done it perfectly, do it like I did. Mm-hmm. Clutter has been a real issue in my life. Yeah. My dad was a hoarder and not a, isn't that funny, hoarder, but like truly somebody who struggled with possessions. Mm-hmm. And so I know that the indecision of I may want to use this again someday, or but what if I need it, or so and so gave it to me, and being stuck in that indecision, to me is really what clutter represents.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit, because I want you to give us a few. I mean, you kind of, this segues well into, give us a few ideas of what some of the biggest clutter traps are out there, because I think some people maybe don't understand even what clutter is as far as what's living in their own home.
Well, I think clothes is a big one. Mm-hmm. And people think, well, if I can keep it all in my room, or if I have enough closets, then it's not really affecting anybody.
Right.
But what I've come to understand is what is that is so much indecision. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has been very helpful, and I think is very helpful for people who deal with clutter, is to really define who they are. Because I think a lot of clothes, it's like, well, I'm kind of this personality on this day at work. I'm this personality when I'm going out with my friends. I'm this when I'm going on a date. And when we can really hone in and be comfortable with who God created us to be and how we want to represent that to the world, we can eliminate a lot of stuff. You know, for a long time when I was a speaker, I would have these blazers, like, because I figured that's what speakers do. They're authoritarian. They're blazers. But when I really discovered, I'm not an educational speaker. I am motivating and entertaining. That's who I am. And that's okay.
And motivating and entertaining is not blazers.
It's not blazers. Yeah. And definitely with like military buttons down the front. That is not me. So when you understand who you are, you're freed up to give that other stuff away.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, I think a lot of people don't understand the decisions or the indecision behind clutter. So what are the things that are kind of keeping people cluttery? Like, are they just too busy and they can't make these decisions, or are they just too emotionally tied to stuff? Like, how's this playing out?
I think it depends on what the situation is. So when you have grandma stuff, that's definitely an emotional attachment. And oftentimes it may not even be an emotional attachment. It may be a guilt attachment, which is an emotion. I get that. But I think we keep a lot of things for three reasons: fear, guilt, and shame. And so one of the things that has really helped me and a lot of my readers is we have three questions about your clutter. And it may not be a clutter. Let's say three questions about your things. Do I love it? Do I use it? Would I buy it again? If you can answer yes to all three of those things, it is not clutter. Please keep that guilt-free. Enjoy it, love it, use it. If you can say yes to one of those things, it's probably still okay, but you may want to reconsider it. If you can't say yes to any of those, then it's clutter and you have to be forced into a decision. And that's where I feel like accountability really helps. If you are struggling with clutter, find somebody else who is too and hold each other accountable and say, hey, I gave these 10 things away this week and let them celebrate with you, because it's hard to do that.
Well, any final, just an encouragement for our audience, those folks that are just like, what really is this going to benefit me? Or, you know, I'm just so, my life is so crazy and I can't, and I want to spend time with my friends. And it's always the draw of like social over, you know, sitting at home going through paperwork.
Absolutely. And I 100% get that. I don't want to rob you of time with your friends, but maybe I want to rob you of time vegging out in front of the TV instead of working on a project while you're vegging out and watching TV. And here is what I've come to understand. When you're more at peace yourself, it's reflected in your environment. But also, when your environment is more peaceful, it's reflected in yourself.
Well, folks, here we are for this week's culture segment, and I have the privilege of introducing you to John Weiss. He is an author as well as a pastor. He is pastor of Southland Christian Church in Lexington. And the book that we're going to actually talk about today is Me Too, Experience the God Who Understands. He also has a book out called Jesus Prom, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, just briefly, because, you know, what in the world is that about? But John, welcome to the Boundless Show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lisa. I appreciate it.
So one thing that's kind of nutty in your story, I mean, you've just been kind of all over. I mean, I want to kind of start out by talking about you spending 4 years in Haiti, which is actually where you met your wife, right?
Yes. My wife and I were school teachers there.
Okay. So did you go to Haiti? I mean, how did that process come about? And I'm assuming you didn't go to Haiti and say, oh, yeah, this is where I'm going to meet my wife.
But no. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't through a dating website.
No.
We didn't have our first date there.
HaitiDate.com?
Right,
no. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Tell us what happened. How did the ministry transpire there, and how did you two meet?
Sure. We both of us grew up here in the States, obviously. My parents had this huge heart for people in need, and so when I was a little boy, they opened up our home to refugees during the Vietnam War. And we had families living with us off and on for 15 years of my life, and then my dad loved picking up hitchhikers and homeless people, and so our dining room table was kind of a revolving door of characters that they would bring in and they would, you know, love on and try to help get on their feet. And so as a kid, I didn't have a difficult time understanding that the love of Jesus translates to every culture and every context. And as I got older, I just honestly was looking to go somewhere where a lot of other people wouldn't go, and Haiti was that place. And I wasn't a school teacher by trade or by education, but ended up there through a lot of, you know, neat circumstances, and was teaching the fourth grade, working with at-risk kids whose parents, a lot of them, had died from AIDS or other poverty-related issues. And my now wife was teaching the second grade, and after a year of friendship development, it was like, wow, she loves living here. This is crazy. And I need to, you know, pursue this friendship a little bit further. And so God just had our paths cross in a really unique way there, and then led us back to the States 4 years later.
Okay. So another kind of nutty thing about your story is that you were only 29 when Southland kind of came knocking at your door and basically saying, hey, do you want to be the pastor of this church?
Sure.
What is that about? How were you even received? And how did you go from, yeah, I was a teacher in Haiti, so now let me just take on this church?
Yeah, well, Haiti and white suburban America are two very different cultures.
I would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, so at 26, I moved back up here, and, you know, I honestly, it was a very loving church family that had incredible DNA spiritually and just had a heart for their community and needed some direction, and I didn't think I was the guy they were going to look at. I was actually playing pickup basketball in the driveway when they called me, and I didn't know I was going to an interview. I was in gym shorts and a sweaty T-shirt, and I walk in this house, and all these church leaders are there, and they had me sit down, and the conversation just took a really neat turn as we talked about simple ways to love our neighborhoods, and mm-hmm. we found common ground in that. And I said, you know, I have no desire to be a pastor. That's not a title I'm really looking for. But, you know, as I follow Jesus, I'd love to encourage other people to do the same. So we had this simple kind of mindset, and I really felt like the Spirit was leading us together. And 16 years later, haven't regretted any of it. It's been challenging at times, but seen a lot of growth, and we're doing a lot of, you know, unique things here in our context.
Yeah. What would you say are some of your personal challenges that you have had to work through that probably informed the book, Me Too? And how, you know, how have you seen those played out, you know, both publicly and privately in the ministry you do?
Yeah, my whole life I've wrestled with fear. Mm. I had extroverted brothers and a sister and a dad, and I always took the back seat, and I was comfortable back there. I didn't like the attention. I didn't want to talk. So God has a funny sense of humor now. You know, I stand up in front of a lot of people, and I have to fight every week fear and just, you know, some people-pleasing tendencies that I've had. I've gone through some counseling for that. And at the same time, my own bag of pain and restlessness that I've just had my whole life. And that's what the book is about. It's, you know, that suffering is the common language of humanity. It's, we're all fluent in it, and it's a common denominator that should draw us together, but instead it tends to drive people apart. Mm-hmm. And I think at our church, that's what we've tried to do, is just build a community centered around honesty and humility, that, you know what, it life's hard, and we don't need to hide that or act like as Christians we're exempt from it. So we've built our whole culture around it, and a lot of that was rooted in my own dealings with God and wrestling with Him as a father and being His son, and trying to come to grips with all the bad stuff I saw in Haiti with people suffering and dying. So, you know, it's been productive. I'm not out of the woods. I don't think I will be until Jesus comes back or I die.
Yeah.
So it's a lifelong battle.
How have you, John, in light of this, I mean, you talked about the community ministry that goes on, the lives, people being in one another's lives, ministering to others who aren't necessarily part of the church. How do you cast a vision for the members of your church who are probably, struggling with, that temptation to wallow in their own misery, you know, focus on their own problems, be all about themselves, to really see that healing can come through community and through being in one another's lives and actually impacting others? How did you cast that vision and how was it received?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the main thing I've done is just talked about my own struggles from stage and let people know that, yes, I'm saved and my sins are forgiven and my eternal destination is secure, but I still have the same issues that everybody else has. My marriage isn't perfect. I'm confused as a parent oftentimes. I wrestle with greed and pride and lust like everybody else does. And so it started with me kind of dropping the guard and losing all the big church lingo and, pastor credentials and all that kind of stuff and just being honest. And people found that refreshing, I think, and at the same time realized that in our own struggle, we do have hope, and that's what the world doesn't have. And so we need to not be stingy with that or keep it to ourselves. We need to share that every chance we get. So instead of coming to church for 1,000 Bible studies, just be Jesus where you're at. Be Jesus in your home. Be Jesus with the people you work with. I coach Little League Baseball, so it gives me a chance on the ball field just to be around families and rub shoulders with people. And I tell our church all the time, just don't be weird. Like, there's enough, like, weird, goofy Christians out there. Mm-hmm. Be true to your personality and who God made you to be. And be honest about what you're really dealing with, and that's magnetic, because the hope part is what most people don't have. They're suffering alone, they're suffering without answers, and we have direction with that, and we need to share that direction.
Yeah, what John would you say like to a Christian millennial in your church who's maybe tempted to hang at the edges of the congregation and what you guys have going on, or else seek out maybe some of the more glamorous opportunities or ministries? What does that look like for a 20-something who needs to understand the value of community and of dying to self and sacrifice for the sake of, the body of Christ?
Yeah, anyone that's in a selfish kind of state, I would say you need to go on a mission trip. You need to come serve. That's our first step out of the weekend service. We want you to serve. You need to roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty. Jesus was a foot washer, and he told us to wash dirty feet. There's nothing glamorous about our role as his disciples. It is all about crucifixion, and it's all about other-centric kind of living. And we don't like that. We are a consumer culture, and we want to get something from this. But what I would tell those folks is you're going to get what your heart desires when you start serving other people. And you can't buy that with money, and you can't find that in a church program. I'm talking about the fruit of the Spirit. You're going to get love and joy and increased, levels of gentleness, and all the things that your heart really craves will come when you lay your life down. So get off your hands, get off your butt, and get in the game. There's too much at stake, and there's too much good that you'll receive when you start to give.
Oh, I love to hear the song of creation, the wind and the rhythm of the rain. Oh, the thunder, it speaks of your power, but there's something in the sound of the saints. I've been washed in the roar of the ocean, found peace in the echoes of a cave. And the trees of the field, they clap their hands, but there's something in the sound of the saints. From the lips of those you saved, a redemption song will rise, with a sound so full it cracks the sky. Whoa!
Well, folks, we are finishing up the show with our inbox, and we are very privileged to have Dr. Carl Benzio, a member of our Physicians Resource Council and a psychiatrist by trade, to answer this question because it is a good one. Welcome, Dr. Carl.
Hey, great to be with you guys.
Great to have you. All right, this listener says, I grew up being told that Christians should be happy and that I should be a good little girl. Now that I'm grown up and not always feeling very happy all the time, I have a hard time letting myself express negative emotions, or I go overboard and unleash the flow. What's the proper way to view negative emotions? How can I get a handle on this and not be afraid of blowing my top at inopportune moments?
To me, I call them not negative, but uncomfortable feelings. Mm-hmm. So these uncomfortable feelings, I believe, are our warning system. Mm. You know, it's what God gave us and built into our system to let us know when there's something not going right, mm-hmm. or when there's potential danger. When we're in the woods and we see a tiger, we should feel anxious, afraid. Mm-hmm. That lets us know, hey, there's something wrong here. There's something potentially dangerous. The second important thing is it's not our decision-making system. So a lot of times we let our feelings become our decision makers. They're terrible decision makers. Mm. You know, whenever we're, you know, as a doctor, they don't let us operate on our kids because we'd be so emotionally involved, we wouldn't be able to see the situation accurately. Mm. You know, they say, you know, you see red with anger, mm. or green with envy, or even love is blind. Mm-hmm. You know, emotions distort our ability to see things clearly. Mm. Certainly, whenever we feel those feelings, we want to soothe first. So let's soothe, whatever that is. It could be as simple as counting to 10. Mm-hmm. Could be splashing water on your face. That's what I do sometimes. Mm. Could be just going for a jog, doing some physical activity. Could be some Bible passages about David and Goliath, Daniel in the lion's den, Jesus dying on the cross that just allow me a sense of peace, a sense of calming and soothing, so then I can start to look behind that red light on my dashboard and say, well, what's the problem that I'm getting warned about? Because mm-hmm. This feeling isn't going to go away until I do something actually about the problem. Yeah. So once I start to problem solve, then that feeling will go away and dissipate.
I get to answer this week's inbox question, which would be awesome, except that this is kind of a hard one. My goodness, this is a difficult position to be in and kind of sad, too. Oh, my goodness. I mean, OK, well, let me go ahead and read it. Our listener is saying, I'd love counsel for how to handle this situation in a godly way. I was talking with a young man that I met online, but after interacting with him over text for a bit, his comments became increasingly sexual, which led me to research him online. Once I Googled his number, I found out he was married, so I cut off all contact with him. I'm concerned because he and his wife are involved and serve in children's ministry at a local church, and I'm concerned about the impact this may have on the kids or how he's even interacting with them. Do you have any advice regarding the godly way to handle this situation? Oh, okay. Well, like I said, first up, this is just tough. I mean, this is difficult. This could involve, I mean, this is involving issues of sin and morality. And the first thing I would say, I think, is you need to make sure you have your facts straight. So are you really sure that this guy is a married man who is representing himself as single on an online dating site? So that said, I think prayer is always key before even approaching anything where you're going to step out and say anything or do anything. I think that that is absolutely necessary. If this guy is legitimately married and you have confirmed that, and he is saying he is a single person in search of women on a what I think might be a Christian dating site here, or he's representing himself as a Christian man, I think that you are fully capable of and probably should first up contact the site, because that is actually a breach of not only confidentiality, but truthfulness for those who are on the site. I would then also, and this is something where I feel like others may advise you differently, I would go to the elders in your church. I would get some other counsel for this, or possibly even have someone else do this on your behalf. But it is very possible that if this person truly is in ministry, is in a public role, is in a role where he is serving on behalf of an actual church staff, I think it might be helpful to contact the leadership there and let that be known. Well, we've got a question today from a guy who basically is having a frustration with a girl that likes him, but he can't reciprocate her feelings. So let me tell you what it's about. He says, I'd like to know what I should do with a girl that likes me. I can't reciprocate her feelings. I've searched my heart for 2 weeks, hung out in person with her, and have talked to our pastor, who knows us both as we're in the same church. And I still find myself not attracted to her in a way that I know a guy should be to honor God to pursue a relationship. I've prayed about it and asked God for wisdom, and he has given me awesome guidance about whether or not I should try a relationship with her, and the answer is no. So I find myself in a position where she wants to be friends and wants to talk every day and so on. However, I just find her conversations taxing and her friendship a burden because we do not agree on most things and do not have similar interests. But since she likes me, she forces a conversation and demands my opinion on things to maintain the conversation. To be frank, she annoys me, and if I didn't want to know the godly way to handle this, I would simply block her, and that would be that. But I'd like to know the best way to handle this situation.
Oh, Lisa, I got to be honest. This one kind of gets on my nerves.
Yeah.
Because I'm hearing three things out of this question. Number one, this guy's not attracted to her. Number two, he has sought counsel and the will of God and gotten clarity he doesn't belong with her. Mm-hmm. And number three, she wants to be friends and talk all the time, but he doesn't even want to be around her. Mm-hmm. So if he's still hanging out with her, here's the thing. He's got major boundary issues. Mm-hmm. Why? First of all, he doesn't know how to say no. Nobody's holding a gun to this guy's head saying that he has to take phone calls from her. Nobody's making him hang out with her and pretend to be her friend, which is what he's doing. And that's dishonest, by the way. Number two, he is not taking responsibility for his own feelings. Instead, he's taking responsibility for hers, which is really unhealthy. He can't control if she feels rejected by his desire to pull away. He has control over himself and the way he communicates his feelings. He needs to own it. The next thing is, his tendency toward being a people pleaser is actually taking precedence over the work of the Holy Spirit in his life. This is the most startling of all. He actually believes God himself is directing him away from this relationship, and that's not enough to make him put up boundaries. If that is truly the case, he's really unhealthy, and I'm willing to bet this is a bigger problem in his life and that it's happening in a lot of relationships that do not honor God.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the best of the Boundless Show for 2016. Once again, let me wish you a very happy new year on behalf of myself and the whole team here at Boundless. May your new year really be full of God's blessings as you get started out in a year really full of hope and expectation. See you next year. I am Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.